Let's continue in 1 Peter. We're in chapter 5 now. And throughout Peter's letter, he has addressed the Christian's relationship with the state. 1 Peter chapter 2, submit yourself for the Lord's sake to every institution. He has addressed our relationship with our employer, the institution of work. Servants, be submissive to your masters. He has also addressed the institution of the family, 1 Peter 3:1. In the same way, you wives, be submissive to your husbands. And then now we see in chapter 5, verse 1, Peter addresses the church. 1 Peter 5:1, I exhort the elders among you. And remember, in regard to these institutions, in regard to government, Christians may have to deal with foolish and ignorant men. Chapter 2, verse 15. And in chapter 2, verse 18, as far as the workplace, Christians may have to deal with unreasonable bosses. And in regard to the institution of family, there are spouses who are disobedient to the word. So in every one of these God-ordained institutions, there are troubles. Not because the institution is wrong, but because they're populated with sinners. So now Peter addresses the church. And the church also may have sinful leadership. Here we see that there might be pastors who pastor begrudgingly rather than voluntarily. Pastors who pastor for money rather than out of righteous passion. And pastors who lead as authoritarian dictators, right? So it's interesting that in these other three institutions mentioned earlier in the book, the person being addressed is the Christian who is being abused by the institution. But here, in regard to the institution of the church, Peter addresses the church and the pastors themselves. 2 Corinthians 5:12, for what have I to do with judging outsiders, but we do judge those within the church. So also, finally, in 1 Peter 5:5, there may be members of the congregation who do not subject themselves to the church elders. So much can be written, much has been written about the role of pastors and congregations, but since the Spirit of God selected these things, here in chapter 5, these points must be of utmost importance. In fact, if there are problems in the pastorate, if there's problems in the congregation, it's likely involving what we see here in 1 Peter chapter 5. So let's begin with just some general truths about the church and Christians and their relationship with the church. Just as we need to take the institution of the state serious and our work serious and our home, we ought to regard the church as a very important institution of God. It's ordained for our good. As we read in chapter 4, verse 17, it's called the household of God. Of course, we know that the church is not the building, it's the people, but the people still actually meet in a location. Can you recall any New Testament verses about the church? Well, let's just cover a few here. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 11. The Lord gave some apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, and some pastors and teachers for the equipping of the saints, for the work of service, to the building up of the body of Christ. And in Acts, we see that the new believers had a passion to fellowship together, day by day, continuing with one mind in the temple, breaking bread from house to house. They were taking their meals together with gladness and sincerity of heart. And in the book of Hebrews, Christians are commanded to assemble together. Do I have that? Yes, Hebrews 10:25. Not forsaking our own assembling together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near. What day is in view? The coming of Christ, when we will certainly be assembled together. But attending church should be more than just obedience to command. It's part of Christian love. John, 1 John chapter 3, verse 14, we know that we have passed out of death into life because we love the brethren. So if you love God, you love Christ, you'll going to want to be with his people. And remember, Christ loved the church. Ephesians 5:25. Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her. Now, I appreciate the nugget of truth in the idea that you don't have to be in church to worship God. But there's also the truth that we must be loyal to God's people and be under the leadership of elders and pastors. Remember, Jesus said, "He who receives you receives me." If you're a follower of Jesus, you are going to show up at the Sermon on the Mount, right? Church attendance in America has dropped every year. Church attendance is really a spiritual barometer, isn't it? More and more Americans have no religion. The percentage of Americans who define themselves as Christian has dropped from 86% in 1990 to 76% in 2008 and only 66% in 2025. Now, as far as regular church attendance, in 2000, 32% of the population attended church. In 2025, it's 20%. But in doing some more web surfing, I came across a study that questioned all of these attendance statistics. For years, pollsters have just been asking adult Americans whether they go to church services regularly. But what people say and what people do are two different things. For example, a Barner research poll showed that 17% of American church members say that they tithe. In other words, they give 10% of their income to the Lord, but in actuality, only 3% do. So there's a 9% gap between what people say versus what they do. And although 20% claim to attend church regularly, the actual statistic is more like 5%. And judging from the number of cars that I see in their driveways Sunday morning here in Old Bridge, church attendance, you know, in our area is probably more like 1%, maybe 2%. And that's kind of to be expected because in Acts chapter 4, the number of those in Jerusalem and in the surrounding area who became members of the church of Jerusalem, it says, was 5,000. I have that? Yes, Acts 4, 4. The number came to be about 5,000. That sounds like a very big church. But the population of Jerusalem and the outskirts at that time was about 150,000. So do the math. At that time, even then, the Christians made up 2 to 3% of the population. But whatever the exact number, there weren't enough Christians to avert the political rebellion in Israel and hence the destruction of the nation of Israel in 70 AD by the Romans. Well, we don't need polling to know that very few people go to church today. We know from practical experience that Christians have always been the minority. But see, statistics help us to further appreciate Matthew 7, verse 13. Enter through the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction, and there are many who enter through it. For the gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life, and there are few who find it. And although at some times the Christian population, which was always only 1 or 2%, at times it made a big impact on the unsaved majority so that Christians became salt and light so that even the unsaved would acquiesce to Christian morals, there are times when the unsaved don't acquiesce. And then we see that Christianity is out of season. But the scripture says to preach the word in season and out of season, right? But think of how much of an affront to God it is that people so willingly leave off the worship of God and the learning of God. A friend of mine had a neighbor who claimed to be a Christian but didn't attend church. And so my friend said to him, "Well, if I didn't like you, I wouldn't want to go to your house anyway." So I think that's a point well made. The reason he wasn't in church was due to his disinterest and maybe even his enmity toward God. It's really no small thing to leave off the worship of God, and God established the fourth commandment for people to set aside time for worship. Exodus chapter 20, remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh is a Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work. If time is not set aside for God and education and the things of God, the people in the nation quickly lose truth and they fall into darkness. Therefore, God's blessing upon the nation and even upon individual families hinges upon giving time to God. Leviticus chapter 26, you shall keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary, I am the Lord. And notice this, if you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments so as to carry them out, then I shall give you rain in their season so that your land will yield its produce and the trees of the field will bear their fruit. Exodus chapter 20, verse 16, because they rejected my ordinances, and as for my statutes, they did not walk in them. They even profaned my Sabbaths, for their heart continually went after their idols. And so Isaiah 58, if because of the Sabbath you turn your foot from doing your own pleasure on my holy day, and call the Sabbath a delight, a holy day of the Lord honorable, and honor it, and desist from your own ways, from seeking your own pleasure, and speaking your own word, then you'll take delight in the Lord. And I will make you ride on the heights of the earth, and I will feed you with the heritage of Jacob your father, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. If you honor the Sabbath, then you'll delight in the Lord. But the further you're away from hearing the word of the Lord, the more you go into darkness. It's really no small thing that in modern America, Sundays become a day for sports because people love their God. And they're lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. Now, as far as being New Testament Christians, we are not Sabbatarians. The Mosaic law to keep the Sabbath is not repeated in the New Testament. You know, given the fact that Paul was a Jewish rabbi, if New Testament Christians were commanded to keep Old Testament sabbatical laws, you could be sure that the Apostle Paul would have listed that in all of his injunctions to the churches in the epistles. But there's not a word. But nevertheless, we still understand that the principles of the Mosaic law still apply today. We're to set aside time for God. Not as a matter of legalism, but from the heart. And if the worship of God was required under Old Testament law, how much more should it be practiced under grace? Here's another thought. Consider the fact that we are the richest nation on earth. We have more leisure time than any other generation. In fact, we have the ability to travel in a fraction of the time what it took previous generations. We can get to church with ease. There are no horses to hook up. There are no livestock to feed in the morning. If we need breakfast before going to church, we've got this big white box, we just open it up and there are eggs in styrofoam containers all nicely lined up and we've got breakfast bars and we got Legos or Eggos, what are they called? don't eat your Legos, they're too hard. If we want oranges all the way from Florida, there's one right there. Bread from bakeries. And yet in the past, when life was so much harder to get to church, more people attended church. The churches were filled, but now they're empty. You would think that given more time and resources, we of all people should be worshiping God more, not less. So this shows greater unbelief and greater ingratitude. What we're seeing in America is a polarization, two classes of people, the church and the unchurched. The unchurched have kind of walled themselves off legally and socially from hearing God's word. And one group is going toward the light, the other is going toward the darkness, and someday there's going to be a big clash. So these are times that test men's souls. All right, let's get to the text. Therefore, I exhort the elders. So what was written before? 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 17. For it's time for judgment to begin at the household of God. And if it begins with us first, what will be the outcome of those who do not obey the gospel of God? So as one commentator writes, the inevitability of earthly trials and of divine chastisement in the experience of God's people makes all the more urgent the need for faithfulness and pastoral care. Given the fact that judgment begins at the household of God, therefore I'm going to urge the elders to do some shepherding, to take care of the sheep. And they need to shepherd the flock of God. Peter says, I'm a fellow elder, and I'm shepherding, and you need to shepherd too. Why do you think Peter said to the pastors they need to shepherd the flock? Does that ring a bell? Well, remember, in John 21:6, Peter had denied Christ. And in restoring Peter, Jesus said to Peter, Simon, if you love me, shepherd my sheep, or in the King James, feed my flock. So Peter's just passing on what Jesus himself taught him, that if you love Christ, then you need to take care of his people and disciple them. And I feel that as a father. I need very little in this life. And if you want to do something for me, just do it for my sons or for my grandchildren. Then you're going to be my hero. And Christ feels the same way about his people. If you want to love Christ, then do something for his people. Peter writes, I exhort the elders. There are three titles in the New Testament for pastors. And in fact, in this text, all three titles are used. Elder, presbytos, referring to the wisdom of the office, verse 1. Pastor, which is really the word for a shepherd, referring to the caring heart of the office. And then notice it says exercising oversight. That is the word for bishop, or the Greek word is episkopos, where we get the word episcopal or episcopalian. And that's to be a manager, like you're the manager of a company. Well, you're to manage God's house, the church. So pastors are called elders, pastors, and bishops. Now, in the medieval church, bishops had a different rank than pastors. It was usually seen that bishops were really above the pastor. But in the early church, and in all New Testament teaching, all three titles refer to the same person in the same office. There are many extra-biblical practices that have entered into organized religion. So if we want to stay faithful to the New Testament, we must realize that there's one office, elder, pastor, and bishop, and there are no longer any priests, there are no popes, or there is no continuing office of apostles. And the creation of new offices and the abuse of these other offices have been a scourge on the church. But nevertheless, there is this calling from God upon certain men to be elders, pastors. It's something more than just a career choice. It's a calling from God. 1 Peter 5:1, I exhort the elders among you as your fellow elder and witness of the sufferings of Christ and a partaker of the glory that is to be revealed. So notice Peter gives a basis for his authority. He is a witness. That's the Greek word. He's a martyr. We think of a martyr as one who dies for the faith, but actually the emphasis is on one who bears witness in a courtroom or a trial, one who sees something, one who gives testimony. And Peter was with Christ on the Mount of Transfiguration. Peter saw Christ's miracles. And for the early church, this was a test of apostolic authority. The question was, is this a letter that was written by one who had seen Christ, one who had been taught by Christ? The answer is yes, then this letter belongs in the New Testament. So the instructions, shepherd the flock of God among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but voluntarily, according to the will of God, not for sordid gain, but with eagerness, nor yet as lording it over those allotted to your charge, but proving to be examples to the flock. So shepherding generally includes all that's involved in the metaphor of shepherding sheep, guiding them to food, protecting them from danger, giving them direction. Exercising oversight is this word for being a manager. Get to that in a minute. Yeah, there's no shortage of people with ordination papers. but there's a shortage of qualified men to manage the household of God. Now, in this exhortation, there are 6 points and 3 pairs. Not under compulsion, but voluntarily. Not for sordid gain, but with eagerness. Not lording over, but proving to be examples. Not under compulsion, but voluntarily, according to the will or calling of God. Now, the first question one might ask is, why would a person be in the ministry reluctantly and not voluntarily? I'm concerned when I hear pastors who give testimonies concerning how they did not want to be in the ministry, but God forced them into it. I kind of wonder about that, because one of the qualifications is 1 Timothy 3. Part of the calling is if a man desires the office of a bishop or elder or pastor, he desires a good work. So having a natural desire for the ministry is actually part of the calling. This injunction also warns us against those in ministry who fall into a begrudging attitude. Oh, I got to preach another message. Oh, I have to visit and talk with those people. Now, at that point, the minister needs to step down and rekindle his love for God and God's people, which is also true for every member of the church. And then, not for sordid gain, but with eagerness. Notice the motive is everything to God. Just like Jesus rebuked the Pharisees for their hypocrisy, why we do what we do is just as important as what we do. And the motive for ministry ought not to be money, but eagerness, literally in the Greek, an inner passion. But you ask, like, who would go into the ministry for money? Pastors as a whole, it's the lowest paid profession. Well, in times past, and in certain places, many in the religion business were well compensated and had an easy life. And in Jewish communities today, the rabbis are very well paid. They're the highest paid men in the community. In fact, I was doing a wedding down in Long Branch at a historic church. I think it was for your daughter. And the church clerk, we got talking, and he talked about how sometimes rabbis would actually use that building. And the first thing that the rabbis would ask is, where's my check? I don't charge for funerals or weddings. It's gratis. But they were getting $1,000 for 20 minutes. 20-minute wedding, you know? I guess I'm in the wrong profession. I speak as a fool. And there are many televangelists who are all about sending in the check. But pastors don't have to be earning 6-plus figures in order to be doing the ministry for money. I've seen pastors who make just an average salary still be motivated by money and job security. They carefully count the offerings. They do things to keep up the offerings. And pastors can be interested in sordid gain, which has nothing to do with money. The motive could be to increase their position, their prestige, their facilities, the size of their congregation. Sordid gain can include the pride of life, gaining reputation. Ministry in general is not a lucrative profession. Paul writes, as poor yet making many rich, as having nothing yet possessing all things. And I suspect that God has ordained that frugality in the ministry to help keep out the wolves. I'd rather be poor as a minister and have that added defense against the wolves. Because we know that if the ministry was a highly paid profession, in any time in history and even today, the wolves always enter in. And that's a whole nother story. Well, just a general application here is what motivates you in life and in your Christian service. Finally, not lording over, but providing to be examples, or proving to be examples. And this speaks to many issues, particularly what is called leadership style, authoritarian leadership, or participation leadership. Pastors are to lead by example rather than by dictate. And Jesus said in Matthew 20, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them, it is not this way among you. But whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant. And there are many verses in the New Testament that emphasize that we are to lead by example. 2 Timothy 3:10, now you followed my teaching, my conduct, purpose, faith, patience, love, perseverance. Philippians 3:17, brethren, join in following my example and observing those who walk according to the pattern you have in us. 2 Thessalonians 3:7, for you yourselves know how you ought to follow our example, because we did not act in an undisciplined manner among you. Or 2 Corinthians 1:24, not that we lorded over your faith, but are workers with you for your joy, for in your faith you are standing firm. So we lead by example. Now, in my ministry, I have received some criticism for not being so authoritarian, specifically about requiring people in the church to do more, you know, demanding that everyone's on time, demanding that people come to all the events. I probably could use a little more authoritarianism. But generally, you know, such a criticism might misunderstand the calling of a pastor and misunderstand the way people actually learn to live right. People are best led by example. Like they say, more is caught than taught. And as it says in that passage in Corinthians, pastors are helpers in your faith. We are not the Lord of your faith. So pastors are not to lead by domination, by intimidation, or even by force of personality. And this applies to other callings, like fathers in the home. Yes, fathers have to lay out the do's and don'ts in the family, but fathers primarily lead by example. Ultimately, you want your children to say, I want to be like dad, rather than just merely saying, I just got to do what dad wants me to do. This text brings up the whole subject of abusive pastors and abusive spiritual leaders. And, you know, that could be, you know, a five-day seminar. And there are many websites covering this subject. Many testimonials. You can go to places like spiritwatch.org. And we just need to be aware of this, that many men go into the ministry for power, for their need to control, or to give themselves feelings of self-righteousness. If they weren't pastors, they'd make good drill sergeants. These are often insecure men. And it's interesting that the ministry can attract some of the worst characters. As is often said, it attracts the best and the worst. Remember, it was the clergy, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, who were most opposed to Christ and put Christ on the cross. And Jesus didn't have many kind words about the clergy in his day. Remember, the wolves feed off the sheep, so they're going to go to the sheep. So congregations need to be very vigilant and not be naive. As it says in 2 Corinthians 11, there are those who disguise themselves as apostles. Well, moving on in the text, 1 Peter 5:4, and when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. So here we find not simply a promise of a reward for being faithful in ministry, but a reminder that the pastor is not a law to himself. He is responsible to the chief shepherd. Peter calls it the flock of God, not the flock of the pastor. And there is no such thing called a crown of glory. The Bible speaks of being crowned with loving kindness. This is not saying that there's this special crown for being a pastor, that when I get there, I'm going to get this crown that says glory on it. The crown of glory is given to all believers. You will be glorified. And if you don't get the crown of glory, you're not a believer. Peter is just reminding the elders of the glory that will await all believers who are faithful to their calling. Now a word to the members of the church. You younger men, likewise be subject to your elders, and all of you clothe yourself in humility toward one another, for God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourself under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you at the proper time. You younger men, subject yourself to the elders. Is this instruction for younger men to listen to older men? Well, that's good advice. But given the context, Peter's really talking about younger men in the faith submitting to their pastors. And again, there's this word, be subject. As we saw in chapter 2, verse 13, submit yourself to the Lord's sake, to every human institution. Chapter 2, verse 18, servants, be submissive to your masters. Chapter 3, verse 1, in the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands. Chapter 5, verse 5, you younger men, subject to yourself to your elders. And notice that subjection can only be accomplished through an attitude, humility. Clothe yourself with humility. Put it on like a garment, just like Christ put on an apron to wash the feet of his disciples. And humility is more than just the feeling of being humble. It's an action. And the action of humility is submission to authority. So how is this to be applied? Well, we should beware of any tendency to ignore the church or to not listen to pastoral leadership. If you think about it, non-attendance is actually a pride problem because one doesn't believe there's anything here for them to learn. Now, there are many people who don't come to church out of pride. There's nothing that pastor can tell me that I don't already know. Yeah, church is for people who need a crutch, and I don't need that, and I'm fine the way I am. Christian spiritual growth sometimes mimics physical growth. Teenagers reach a point where they think to themselves, my dad doesn't know anything. And Christians can enter a teenage stage of their spiritual life where they begin to think, hey, my pastor doesn't know anything. Now, it is true that you can outgrow your pastor or your spiritual leader, but we may not know as much as we think we know. As Paul writes to the Corinthians, if anyone supposes that he knows anything, he has not yet known as he ought to know. Why would Paul write to the Corinthians those words? Well, they were new believers and they were starting to learn some biblical truths, but they didn't understand the entire breadth of Scripture. You know, a pastor may give a message or some counsel and the Christian thinks, well, I know that, that's too basic. Or he missed that point. You know, if I was preaching that sermon, I would have said this, that, and the other thing. And the pastor's not really addressing what I think is important in the Bible. But if you think about it, in any interpersonal relationship, in any conversation with somebody else, you're going to know something more than another person knows. So all human interaction can give a proud person the impression that they know more than others. But I'm not a pastor because I know more than other people. It's not because I'm smarter, it's because I'm your servant. Now, Peter gives a very important reason why we should submit to God's leadership. Because God honors those who respect authority. God is opposed to the proud, he gives grace to the humble. Peter's actually quoting Proverbs chapter 3, verse 34. If we want God on our side, then we need to be humble and submissive. But if we want God to be fighting against us, then be proud and self-willed. This word humbling yourself means an active cooperation. You're doing it to yourself. You're humbling yourself rather than God having to humble you through the school of hard knocks. And I love this point. Leave it up to God to exalt you in his time rather than always trying to exalt yourself. Finally, verse 7, casting all your anxiety on him because he cares for you. Question, what does anxiety have to do with humbling yourself before God? We'll find that the reason we have anxiety is mostly due to our failure to submit to God's will. And the reason we don't submit to God's will is usually our pride. Let me close with a testimony from a missionary in Latvia, one of those Baltic states. He writes this, we were constructing a huge church facility many years ago in the Republic of Latvia. a former Soviet nation where a family once lived and worked. Worry and anxiety controlled me. In fact, worry nearly broke me until I really came to understand and embrace the meaning of 1 Peter 5:7. At that time, no credit was available for building churches in the nation. This meant we had to believe for all the finances to come in quickly so we could pay cash as we were constructing the massive facility. Then the local authorities gave us a deadline by which the building had to be completed and occupied. Otherwise, there was a possibility we could lose everything we had invested. With this kind of pressure on me, I found myself constantly worrying that we wouldn't have enough money to finish the project on time. I was constantly fighting thoughts about losing the building if we didn't make the deadline that the government had given us. I would lie in bed at night, rolling this way and that way, turning again and again, unable to sleep because my stomach was churning with acid and my mind was spinning with doubts, worries, fears, reservations, and concerns. My heart pounded harder and harder each day and night as anxiety reached out its demonic fingers to grab hold of my emotions and twist them into a mangled mess of panic. My wife would tell me to quit worrying and start trusting the Lord, but instead of appreciating her advice, I got angry that she wasn't worrying with me. So how could a missionary who knows the Word of God have anxiety over building a building for God? Well, I remember early in my Christian experience, I used to worry the same way. Now it seems so godless. I realized the source of that anxiety. Because always, rather than submitting to God, I had to have what I wanted to have. I was unwilling to accept the possibility that my plans were not God's plans. And hence, I feared God would shut down my plans. And that was my pride. That was my unsubmissive spirit. And that's why we don't cast all of our cares upon the Lord. You know, if God caused circumstances so that that missionary couldn't finish that building, guess what? God didn't want them to build that building. The only reason he was in anxiety is because he had to have that building. He really had not placed it on the altar before God. Well, the testimony continues. Finally, one night I got up, walked down the hallway to my study, opened the Bible and read these words, "Casting all of your cares upon him, for he cares for you." I had read this verse thousands of times in my life, but that night it was as if it reached out of the pages of the Bible and grabbed hold of my attention. I read it and read it and read it again. At last, I picked up my Greek New Testament and began to dig deeper into the verse. What I discovered in that verse changed my life and set me free from worry, anxiety, fretting, and fear. That night I saw that the word casting, used in 1 Peter 5:7, was the Greek word, a compound word, meaning upon and to throw, or to hurl something violently upon something else with great force. But exactly what problems and cares are we not throwing on the shoulders of the Lord? The Apostle Peter says we're to cast all of our cares upon Jesus. The word cares in the Greek means anxieties. However, in principle, it describes any affliction, difficulty, hardship, misfortune, trouble, or complicated circumstances that arise as a result of problems that develop in our lives. It could refer to problems that are financial, marital, job-related, family-related, business-oriented, or anything else that concerns us. If you're lugging around worries, cares, and concerns about your family, your business, your church, or any other area of your life, why not stop right now and say, "Jesus, I'm yielding every one of these concerns to you today. I cast my burdens on you, and I thank you for setting me free."